Welcome to Parallel Lines, and this is a first, really, because Anna Jane and I are a couple of hundred miles apart, possibly, for this one, for the first time, not in the same room, on Teams, and our guest that we'll introduce in a moment is also on Teams. So I'm looking at a screen of pictures, and we're using all this technology to link up. Who'd have thought it? But it should be fantastic. But if there's the odd pause, it's because we're not used to not being able to kick each other or glare at each other while the conversation is going on. So I'm going to have to watch the camera instead. So Anna Jane, it's great to see you again. You better update us on how you are, where you are, and what we're doing today.
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Tony. So, yeah, such is our level of commitment to Parallel Lines that we don't let the summer get in our way or holidays or anything, you know, like that. So I've gone... Not that I'm ever not in the north, at least in spirit, if not in location. I'm even further north than usual in the lovely homeland of Northumberland, which is where my soul is happiest. So I'm here for the weekend. And we have another Parallel Lines first, because our guest today is our first ever MBE, which is quite exciting on the show. So I will, with great pleasure, introduce my friend, I think, on the railway, it's fair to say, because we've known each other a few years now, the lovely Lucy Pryor. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. And I always blush when people mention my Blue Peter badge. So thank you.
I have to, because it's quite a coup for us, because there are many luminaries of the rail industry, aren't there? And we have MBEs and OBEs and CBEs and all the rest of it. But to be in the presence of one is rather lovely, actually. And maybe we'll talk about that in more detail. Maybe we won't, if it makes you blush, because, you know, we don't want to embarrass you.
Why are we all meeting together today, Anna Jane?
In another Parallel Lines first, we're going to talk about something that is simultaneously very railway and not railway at the same time. What Lucy's up to at the moment is working for a wonderful organisation called the Mental Wealth Company. And we'll get into loads of detail about what that is. But this is something that affects all of us. And some of us don't realise it. It affects the railway, I guess you could say, in some ways more than other industries. We might get into that a little bit and talk about that some more. And I think probably all of us have got somebody in our lives who's been touched by this, even if you don't perhaps realise it or talk about it as much as we should do. So some of those are the things we're going to talk about. But we'll ease ourselves in gently, I think. What do you reckon, Lucy? Ease ourselves in gently?
I think so. Let's ease in.
So do you want to just tell us a little bit? Let's just start off and just in terms of what is the Mental Wealth Company, if people haven't heard about it, if they've heard nothing else about it, what actually is it?
Okay, so I am totally biased because I work here right now. But the Mental Wealth Company was set up, we had our 6-year anniversary on the second day of Red Live this year. And that was it's a real moment for us. So the Mental Wealth Company, it is a consultancy, a training provider and a coaching provider in and around everything to do with organisational well-being. Now, all of us that work in the company have a background in rail, so our clientele tend to be in rail, and that's definitely where we all hail from. So I've got almost 2 decades working in rail in a sales, BD, engagement type roles. But Wendy McChrystal, who set up, she's the MD and the founder of the company, and our lead trainer, so she's a human factors expert. She's got a master's in engineering, I believe it is. She's a proper brain. She's really, really clever. One of her proudest moments is designing the step on the JCB. So she's worked out of rail as well. So human factors in terms of the physical design of machines that we work in and on. And she ended up working in rail. So she designed trains, the cab layout for the drivers, the height of the seat to the pedal, all of that stuff. I heard actually you talking about that with Jenny Dempsey on a previous episode. Yeah. So it's the ergonomics and then some. And that was her background. So very engineering led, very scientific led. She also did other work in terms of, for example, she's one of the critical investigators on disasters such as Ladbroke Grove and Croydon Tram and others. So she really has been involved in some of the really deeper, darker parts of the railway as well, I'd say. Mm-hmm. She has an utter love and admiration for the human psyche. And she tells a story herself so well and so emotionally, I can't try and replicate it. I'd urge you all, if you haven't, to listen to Wendy's story. But ultimately, in a nutshell, after a number of years of working in a very hectic corporate environment, managing a team of a couple of hundred people, she had burnout. She was signed off for one day with stress by the doctor, who pretty much insisted that she did it. And she was like, no, I don't need this. And she ended up having 6 months off work on no sick pay or anything. But she just then recognised that her body and her brain and her soul needed that break. she did go back into corporate world, but she could feel things building back up again. And in and amongst that, in her recovery time, she has a very specialist coaching and training herself. And she, it's like she had a light bulb moment. And I actually remember meeting her on the way into, I think it was the Golden Spanners, Tony. She was presenting that day. And it was palpable. You could sense she was getting back there again. And she decided that she was setting up an organisation to help people avoid what she'd gone through. And she's got a mission of helping a million people avoid breakdown or burnout or whatever it may be. So the training that she provides, the coaching that she provides, is all around helping people avoid and mitigate reaching that state for themselves, or looking after their teams and their colleagues to help them avoid it as well.
Pretty unique, isn't it, Tony? Have you heard much about this? Are you familiar?
Not the actual company, but I'm aware of particularly the sort of career burnout thing, or the issue of people that just go at 100% until they just find that they can't even get 1% and they just hit a wall. And that thing, and the reasons behind it, things like, I don't want to let anyone down, or I feel that I daren't say that I need some time because it might affect my career or whatever, or I don't want to let clients down, or I don't want to let my team down. So that whole thing I can understand fully, and having known people who got close to it, yes, once the balance is being restored, you do see it in their face. We won't mention any names. Anna Jane and I were discussing someone the other week who we know very well, who'd gone through a really difficult time, and I said, they look 10 years younger. And really, the whole, once they'd got out of the situation and had some time away from the stress, it's amazing. So that the understanding, it's one of those things, and I guess railways is one of those things, yes, because it's serving lots of people. You feel you're letting people down if you're not pulling your weight, and you don't even notice the way it's building up in you to start with.
I mean, a really interesting element of this is one of the specialisms is in non-technical skills. Now, as Anna definitely knows, Tony, you're about to find out because you've just connected with me on LinkedIn, there's a whole load of talk around non-technical skills, NTS, on LinkedIn, and the importance of these softer skills and human skills. We have, of course, all centered on that, but with an extra layer of well-being wrapped into it. And it is just, it's staggering and inspiring to see the difference in people physically, the difference in people when they've gone through this NTS training and they have a newly discovered appreciation for the importance of well-being in able to help them carry out their more technical role at work. Anything from, we talk about drivers an awful lot. It's probably one of the easier roles that we can all relate to. I'm going to name drop my friend Heather Waugh, for example. So Heather, female freight train driver. We can talk about the hygiene conditions on the Class 66 in another call. But let's say I have spoken to Heather and other freight train drivers, and if they know they've got a night shift coming up, they will make sure they're not drinking too much water before a shift to make sure they don't need a comfort break. Now, if you're working, I don't know, an 8-9 hour shift, I don't know what the actual shift times permissible are, but let's say it's an 8 hour shift in the dark on your own, with no music, you can't wind the window down, and you've not had enough water, you've not drunk a lot of water to make sure you don't need a comfort break. The impact physically on you, the mental exertion, the physical exertion, and it's having that awareness and looking after your well-being in that larger context, it really is staggering the difference it makes. And that has a direct and immediate impact on safety, on productivity, on performance. The most important thing is it's looking after that individual. It's making sure that they are well in themselves. But the benefits of that person being well to everyone, you just can't put a number on it.
Some of that's about where the mental health and physical health aspects kind of overlap, don't they?
Absolutely.
You know, in that NTS space, because sometimes they manifest and overlap, don't they? But should we go back a bit? I feel like we've missed a beat here, because you kind of skipped over there, didn't you? Your 20 years in rail and your colleagues in the mental wealth company who also have a background in rail. But we really want to hear a bit about you, Lisa, because I think your career is really interesting, because it's really unlike my own. And we've heard lots on the podcast about my career and others who are more on the what you might call the more visible and traditional side of the railway, you know, train operating companies, network rail, etc. But you've existed in other parts of the industry that people might not see quite as much of and might not know as much about. So tell us a bit about some of the things you've done, you know, over the years.
Yeah, well, I consider myself to be really, really lucky. I've had some amazing jobs in railway. And like a lot of others, I got into it by accident. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I was a grown up. I still don't. But I absolutely knew that I wanted to study languages at university and then go travelling. So I did it. I studied languages at university, French and Spanish, got myself a purposefully dead-end job so I could save up some money and go backpacking. So I joke that I've had probably about 3 gap years. After as much time as I could backpacking around Morocco and South America and, you know, jobbing it in restaurants and admin jobs and stuff. After my last stint coming back from South America, where actually I've had some really cool train trips. If you ever get the chance to do the train up to Machu Picchu, do it. It is phenomenal.
I'll add it to the list.
Oh, honestly, it's so cool. You have to zigzag up and down the hill because the gradient is so steep. And back then, I didn't understand. I'm not an engineer, but now I understand the gradients and the radii question. You couldn't send it straight. Anyway, that's an aside. I came back. I'm from South Yorkshire originally. I joke that I emigrated to Sheffield from Doncaster, and people think I sound really parochial, but I did that via Bristol and South America. So, you know, I have been out of the county. But yeah, after a couple of years, returned to a job in recruitment for chefs, which was interesting. And I needed to sit still for 2 years, prove to a future employer that was a safe bet. And I literally went to a local recruitment agency who specialised in language speakers. And I said, I want a job where I'm selling things in foreign languages, please. That was my brief. And I think maybe 4 or 5 weeks later, I was on a stand at Innotrans selling jacks.
Jacks?
Yes, selling train jacks. And, you know, it was fantastic. They'd taken me on initially as export sales because of the languages background. We wanted to break into the French and the German markets, for example, in Spain. So I've had some amazing trips around mainland Europe and some of the North African locations as well, all in the name of selling jacks and lifting trains safely. We were talking about Pendolinos before we were recording. Yeah, I've been to some very interesting depots where, let's say, safety over there isn't the same as safety over here, or certainly wasn't back then. But at the time, I don't think so. Richard Carr was the MD of Mecan at the time. He and I didn't appreciate how long you need to invest time-wise in export sales. And if you imagine, it takes long enough building up a relationship in your mother tongue in your own country. You need to do that and need to demonstrate you've got support networks in country as well, wherever you're working. So I've had some really cool business relationships in Morocco and Spain and France, and it's ace. But like, this isn't moving quickly enough, and I've got to earn my wage. So they put me on to sales generally across all of the UK, and it was brilliant. Because I pretty much shadowed the engineering director, an old guy called Graham Cofield, who was ex-BR. He grew up on the sidings in Doncaster. He was mates with a really cool gang of, I call them the old boys affectionately, because that's what they call themselves. So if you've heard of Jack Pendle, for example, and there was a whole load of them. They took me under their wing, and I literally went around depots from the top of the country to the bottom of the country with Graham, ones which were makeshift, that were under scrutiny for safety conditions, others that were just built. So my first British depot was Crofton, which was a temporary one. It was basically a souped up marquee. And then my second British depot was Ashford.
Quite different.
So, yeah. You've got a same shui depot. This is amazing. And like the clean lines on the floor. And yeah, and I am really sad in that if it's a depot I've been to, I'll know what lifting equipment they've got in there. And I love it.
I think we might have met someone, Tony, who's got a greater affection for maintenance depots than even I have.
Yeah,
it's a topic that we've covered a few times.
You've been completely outflanked there. Yeah, but you can't even name what jacks are in Heaton Depot.
I couldn't name you one. No.
Okay, well, I would, but they were a refurb when I was there, and I'm new.
Something else interesting you just said there, Lucy, that's just cropped into my head, because this time of year, we're recording at the end of August. There's just been exam results out, you know, of various different types. A lot of the conversations I've been having in my personal life are about GCSEs and A-level results, and kids who are into languages, you know, it's often a bit like, what do you do with that? You know, I think parents can feel a bit like, what can my child do with this if they don't want to be a language teacher or, you know, work for the Foreign Office? Selling things in the rail industry or being involved in the rail industry, there's so many companies that are from Europe in our supply chain, aren't there? Whether it's kit, trains, you know, the whole caboodle, isn't there?
Oh, it's amazing. So I have live translated in Madrid at the British Embassy for product launch.
Wow.
I've been an interpreter in and around depots in France and Morocco. I've not necessarily to do with my languages, but in terms of that international aspect, my previous role was working for a company called TTS, Toftec Systems, and we were the distributor of a product manufactured in Japan. Now I'm all about supply chain and you know, supporting local, but it depends. You have to have the appropriate sourcing. But taking a convoy of Japanese delegates around the UK, getting to meet the DFT, what was BEIS at the time, who else did we meet? Like three or four government departments, and showing them how we do things differently. But then again, using my languages, I used to work at a trade association called the Rail Alliance. Colin Flack, who runs the Alliance, he was brilliant, but he was a bugger because he would drop me into some right old situations. So I've done everything from essentially a silent disco conference in the Northeast at a machine tool show, giving a presentation there, to I represented the UK by a Basque-British bilateral trade deal conference. Yeah. And I'm sat alongside some amazing grown-ups, and I'm there talking in Spanish about innovation in Crossrail. I'm like, is this happening? And then also,
how did you get on with the Basque stuff? Because I somebody close to me worked with the guys from the Basque region a lot on a railway project, and I gather even the Spanish speakers can struggle a bit with those guys, because they go into their own little world, don't they?
They were very welcoming. They let me speak Castilian and not fail at Basque, which was
okay,
a massive relief. But then I had another incident where I was taking a delegation from Medellin Metro from Colombia, taking them around the UK to light rail depots. So we had an amazing visit to Transport for Greater Manchester when Louise Cheeseman was still there. So bless her, she humoured me going, Louise, I need to do this. Can I? She's like, yeah, she can. We went round, and it was the first time we'd seen a tram maintenance depot built with passive provision for future demands. And that was amazing for me to learn. Also bless them, we were taking them to see Nottingham Tram. We were travelling from Birmingham. The train broke down at Long Eaton. We had to travel back to Birmingham and get another route. So, yeah, I also got those Colombians trapped in a lift in Sheffield. You get to do some really, really interesting stuff, being able to speak languages and work in railway. It's very cool.
I mean, that sounds like quite the challenge. You translated Louise Cheeseman's Hull accent into Mancunian and out the other end into Spanish for the Colombians. That's not easy. Yeah.
Well, I've also, one of the highlights of my career then was I have translated 10 documents for controlled emission toilets into and out of Spanish. Oh, wow. Don't speak Italian, but I've worked on sandy machines. I've got a general gist of Italian, because a lot of the technical terms you can pretty much transfer across the Latin languages. So yeah, sandy machines, CT machines, jacks, bogey drops, all sorts of stuff in all sorts of languages. Oh, and that was just my first job in rail. I've worked on permanent weight products, friction management, like the trade association, like I said. Been a few years in software, and that came around because I'd been at the Rail Alliance for quite a while, and it's when the talk of fourth industrial revolution and digitalization was really starting to bubble to the top, and we were talking about localization and regionalization. And I'd done a whole load of one of the really cool things that I did for Rail Alliance, and this is one of the best things I've gotten involved in. I loved it. At the time, the LEPs, the local enterprise partnerships, they were all essentially bidding to the train builders as to where they should locate their build and maintenance depots. So every LEP in the north had their own pitch. I was commissioned to write a pitch for the whole of the north, and that was really cool. But like I said, around all that time, fourth industrial revolution and digitalization was kicking off, and I was offered a role at a software firm in Leeds. And I'm like, do you know what? We keep talking about digitalization, keep talking about local, we keep talking about SMEs, let's give it a go. So I worked at RTS for a year, then moved across to Three Squares, which was brilliant and interesting. But then I missed actual tangible physical things, and then I moved across to TTS, so that ancillary products for the civil side of the industry. So yeah, very varied.
Well, so you like a new challenge, clearly.
Yeah. Give it a go.
But can that have a knock-on for some people who are constantly wanting a new challenge, that, again, in terms of mental health, they're constantly climbing the ladder and not realising that maybe they need to pause on a rung for a while and just enjoy being where they are?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, I know I've been really fortunate. I've had a couple of really, really good bosses along the way. So I mentioned Richard Carr, who was at MEC, and he's now at RIA. And another former boss who was fab, I've worked with him twice, is a chap called Gary Elliott, who's my MD at TTS. And I'm specifically mentioning those two guys, A, because they're brilliant allies. Because I know, Anna, Jane, we're both in Women in Rail, and I'm involved in Women in Transport as well. And that's partly to do with my badge as well. They are supportive guys who employed me because I could, not because I was a woman. Now, Richard was a little bit canny at the time. He did know that I would stand out. So, for example, at the very first Golden Whistles it was that I went to, I was literally the only person under a certain age, and I was the only woman in the room not wearing waiting on clothes. And it was terrifying. Yeah. I'm surrounded by all these old blokes in very posh suits. And the only person I knew was somebody from Heathrow Express who was getting an award for retirement. And he was heading towards retirement. He was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I'm like, what do I do? And from that point, now absolutely adoring networking. Yeah. Mm. So you have the baptisms of fire, but if you have a working environment that supports you and allows you to be yourself and also supports you to make a few mistakes along the way, because I certainly have, it's all learning, isn't it?
Tony, I think you famously on episode number one of the podcast, we shared how Tony referred to me as being like Nessa, which I was insulted by. But what he was actually referring to is the many jobs that I've done in my short, at the time, life. It was a long time ago.
Because Anna-Jane's only in her mid-20s, right. And yet she's had at least 30 jobs, it seems to be. You know.
But I think Lucy wins. I think Lucy beats me. She's the ultimate Nessa.
Which years were you dating John Prescott? No, but as you've mentioned bosses, and you mentioned it earlier as well, and I think this is probably quite key to our discussion. I had 30 years in higher education as well in university, and the promotion of people to be managers of people, particularly not the straight academics, but all the support teams and all the researchers and everything. The one thing they never seemed to be asked or supported in was, do you know how to look after a team of people? I was going to say manage people, and I'm avoiding that really because it's more than that. Do you understand people? Do you know how to spot when somebody's struggling? Do you know how to talk to them quietly over a coffee in a room nowhere near everybody else because clearly they might want to talk about something? And to the point where I had a line manager at one point who was actively bullying and was very difficult to catch. There was a long period of how do we catch this person? And I know people in other spheres of employment where the people they're working under have got absolutely no skills or very few skills in actually leading a team of people properly. And it doesn't seem to have been the thing that was ever asked at the interview, really. Mm. And nobody that they'd sort of looked after in a lower grade job was asked, how are they as a boss, as a manager, as someone who leads you? How do you find working for them? That seemed to be ignored completely. And I have seen it in occasional places in the rail industry as well. So is that something
occasional? No, it's all over the place.
I was being incredibly polite so that you would come in and override me there, because I've
Lucy
not
mentioned train drivers. We always come back to train drivers, I feel like. Not always, we often come back to train drivers, but a lot of the work I've been doing in recent years in my day job has involved this issue that we've got with, we promote people because they're technically great at their job, so that's why you become the manager, and then actually, you know, we spend very little time developing the human side of leadership and how you need to actually, as you say, look after a team. That's a really nice way of putting it, actually, Tony. I don't think people describe it as that very often. They might say leadership, or they might say pastoral care, or, you know, people management as opposed to just management. But actually, it is looking after a team, isn't it? And I think this training that you guys are offering is really part of that, because when we have safety critical workers like drivers, but not just drivers, how they're feeling in their personal life, in their head, in their, you know, approach to the world, that permeates how they do their technical job, that how it impacts, doesn't it, how they turn up to work.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I'll do the training bit. So one of the programs we do is resilience training. And a lot of people that come through our courses aren't necessarily in the right, it's not something they would necessarily look to do for themselves. So we did this massive resilience program of over a year long with Network Rail's On Track Plant On Track Machine team. Senior guys, amazing engineers, brilliant people in themselves. Obviously, I'm going to anonymize all of this, but I remember speaking to one of the alumni, let's call them. He was like, oh, one of the guys on the course, brilliant engineer, crap at looking after people. All he cared about was hitting the numbers, 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 productivity rates. But he's done this course. And so it was everything around well-being. There was coaching in there, training in there, one-to-one stuff. He's come out and all like, he's happier. He's a nicer manager, nicer leader, better leader. But as a result, his team are happier. His team feel more secure. They can speak up when there's a problem. And now people in that team are then owning incidents that have happened, so you can learn from them rather than hide them. So that whole resilience and non-technical skills, and I talk a lot about psychological safety as well. Creating a space in which people can, whether it's a younger member of staff who's newer in their role, go, well, actually, I've got this idea. Can we use this? Or somebody more experienced going, well, we have always done it this way, but let's try this instead. Or, no, that's wrong, I disagree. Anywhere within that spectrum, having that culture that allows people to speak up and question and put ideas forward and put different ideas forward, it makes for a better organisation. Yeah.
And being able to say that you don't get something or you're not comfortable with something, this whole thing of psychological safety, I love that phrase, and overlapping with actual traditional safety, you know, the safety critical environment in which we work, I think, again, is really so important because we deliver a lot of information to our staff, our safety critical staff. They get briefings, they get, you know, technical training, but we've got this link into the women in rail thing, this culture of machismo and, like, you know, it's not okay to say, hang on a minute, I didn't understand that, or I'm not comfortable with that, or I feel like I need some more time on that. I didn't quite, you know, get it first time. Being brave enough, you shouldn't need to be brave. Brave's not the right word, is it? You should just feel safe that you can do that without being criticized or without somebody saying you're terrible at your job. And, you know, that psychological safety thing is interesting around that.
Yeah. And I think as well, even the best leaders, let's use that phrase, do need to reflect on their own styles. So again, a previous person that I worked for, brilliant boss, but I was being teed up for succession planning. And he said to me, you're really good at this, that, and the other, Luce, but it almost feels like you're mothering the lads, because it was a factory environment. You know, you're mothering them. And actually, I was just doing it differently. And at the time, it just kind of floored me and I felt a bit like, what? But like, no, I was just doing it differently. And it got to a point where I would have guys in this factory come up to me and talk about stuff in their personal lives that they'd hidden and wouldn't bring to the fore. The fact that they could speak about it to somebody at work and know it was confidential, I wouldn't share it.
Yeah.
But again, you could see the difference in how they operated with you, and therefore knowing that they could share a secret with you, if you like, meant that they knew that they could question things in the day-to-day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't like applying gender stereotypes, but physiologically and socially, in the way that we've been socially conditioned as well, women do work differently to chaps. And that machismo, it is still there.
It's real. It is.
It is real. And it's a shame for the fellas as well.
Mm-hmm. The example I can think of, Lucy, is years ago when I was in a frontline management role, it was when, you know, fatigue was starting to be really the kind of thing of the hour. And I remember receiving a management briefing, as you do, about, oh, we're going to have this fatigue risk index calculation and people are going to self-report if they're fatigued, you know, and teaching us the difference between tiredness and fatigue and how it's different. Mm-hmm. And staff should be allowed to come to work and say, I'm fatigued, I'm not fit for work, you know. And the uproar from my male colleagues, now I was the only female in the room, my male colleagues gone, their assumption, well, everyone's going to do that, aren't they, because they just want to swing the lead, they're obviously all going to turn up and say they're fatigued. And it was like, lads, you're missing the point, you know. You need people to be able to come to work and say, I've got a young baby, they've kept me up all night, or, you know, next door had a party and I didn't sleep well, you know, whatever it might be that's going on in your personal life, being able to bring that to your manager and say, look, I don't quite feel right to work today. They're not going to do that every day just because they want to be off sick. No.
And like, that's fascinating, isn't it? Creating categories. I've spoken to conductors who said, I've had to self-report that I couldn't carry on with my shift because I'd been in a carriage where too much was being smoked of something and I would fail the drugs test. Seriously, a couple of times they said that I was aware that it was so strong that I thought if I got random tested, I'd be worried. And I was aware that I was feeling bad. So, and everyone said, good on you for reporting that, because if you'd carried on, something had happened, etc. And if the same person has said, I'm absolutely exhausted, something happened at home, we were up all night or whatever, and I feel like I've completely lost focus on what I'm doing, people say, oh, come on, you know, just have a strong cup of coffee and you'll be okay. And we categorize two things.
Yes,
just man up or whatever and you'll get through it. But actually, both of those circumstances could lead to exactly the same mistakes happening. And we're putting things in boxes the wrong boxes, and somebody wanting to be honest and saying I'm not fit for work because something happened in our neighbourhood or whatever, or in the family, and I am not focused on the work, I need to stop. People will be terrified of doing that.
Yeah, and I'll give another example of bad psychological stigma. This is anecdotal, and I wasn't on the train myself, but a story I've heard from one of the operators. We're in very much a litigious fear society, aren't we? The fear of... It was a story whereby there was a train that was halted for whatever reason. Let's assume a signalling failure. There was a family with a young baby. They wanted to warm some milk up. The onboard crew would not give them a cup of hot water for fear that somebody might hurt themselves.
Yeah, we're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, it was easy for them to have a crying, distressed baby than risk a grown adult burning themselves from a cup of hot water that they'd asked for.
Yeah,
it's that, how do we empower people to make the right decision in the right moment?
Yeah,
yeah, and to feel safe doing that. Yeah, yeah, we spend such a lot of time and money training people to do their job and do it well. Yeah. Then we take away all the empowerment and the perception is that we do. And sometimes I think, you know, people can, oh, I'm not allowed to do that, I'm not empowered. When really we think as leaders that we have empowered them, but it's about living and breathing it and constantly reminding people that they can and showing them that they can, because the repercussions aren't there if they choose otherwise. Yeah.
And I'd argue allowing onboard staff as well to say that they don't know. So, and I know that you guys have talked about this in the past as well, but if you're in a Wi-Fi black spot, if you can't look at open train times, for example, yourself, I mean, we're all geeks essentially. We know where to look for this information. Yeah. If you are Joe Public and you haven't got a clue where to look, you are at the mercy of the people on the train telling you when your train's going to get there. If they don't know, they should be able to say that they don't know, because that clarity of communication, I don't know, but I will find out for you as soon as I can, you're going to have a much happier delayed customer than someone else who's in limbo, someone else who has the fear of the unknown. Because ultimately, we all want that autonomy and we all need that information. So even if we can just be told, I can't give the information now, but as soon as I'm able to, I will, that is the level of customer service that we need to be able to empower our colleagues in front of customers to be able to give.
That general feeling of being empowered to make a decision and being okay if afterwards it was considered by a manager that wasn't the best decision to make, but I understand you made it in the best with best intentions. Okay, and here's what you're doing the future, kind of thing. Feeling that you're not going to be, and we've discussed this on previous podcasts, feeling that you're not going to be chastised or disciplined or even fired for making a mistake. And the case of the hot water for the baby's milk, maybe if the catering people had said, bring the baby right next to the kitchen so we don't have to carry lots of hot water up and down the train, you bring the baby to us, we'll hand you the warm water right next to us, is that a good compromise? But you've got to be empowered to do a bit of thinking and feel it's okay for me to think, and then to be able to say we felt that was the best decision to make in the circumstances. And you might even get a letter from the parent saying, you know, fantastic, they found a solution and really appreciate it. And that comes,
and lo and behold, that goes on social media and everybody gets a feel good factor and more people travel on that service.
Absolutely. And that's back down to the management thing of people, how they relate to their managers, how they relate to the people who are their team leaders or whatever. And I can relate to you sort of just briefly the difference between different senior people. I was in the cab of a train many years ago with the driver officially, and as we pulled into a station, I spotted on the platform a senior director from their company, and I said, oh, look, so and so's getting on the train. And the driver said, who? And they'd never met nor even knew the name of someone who was one of probably the safety case holders for their company. And it was someone who never, ever sort of wandered around on trains or introduced themselves or whatever. And then the complete opposite, which I reminded, I'm actually going to name the name here because it was Tim Shoveler. Years ago when Tim Shoveler was just a mere TOC MD. And I was on the phone to him checking something, and he was on a station platform, and he said, hold on a mo, and he came back, he said, driver just wanted to show me how he'd kept the train in service using a matchstick. And he said, the driver gone, boss, come and look. Now that's the complete opposite, isn't it? You've got a member of staff there who might even be told by the mates, you don't want to be talking to those management types, but he was really proud of what he'd done, and he wanted, and he spotted the boss, recognized the boss, knew he could talk to the boss, and so wanted to share the thing he'd done for the company. And two completely different ways that people understood senior people in their company, and which one did they enjoy working for most, I hope.
I think Tim Shoveler, there are a couple of others we could name who are just known for being fantastic bosses and who get involved and know what it's like. You know, they do the shifts themselves in every different bit of their operation. And that is invaluable.
Yeah. We're still hoping to try and talk to Chris Green at some point, legendary former manager. But I remember trying to get hold of him one weekend many years ago when he was running Virgin, trying to get hold of him to ask something. Couldn't get hold of him all weekend. Finally got him on the Monday. Where were you? So I was at Birmingham International carrying bags because there was a blockade on. So there is the thing. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to sit in my home while other people are working. I'll be there carrying the stuff. And that's the thing. And then back to the other way, and particularly understanding people who are going through challenges. Let's move it on a tiny bit. Mm-hmm. Quite a few years ago, I spoke to a driver who'd been involved in a fatality. They'd hit a vehicle with someone in. And not only was that distressing enough, but they'd run forward to where the vehicle had ended up and seen what had happened, which had caused more distress. And after a year, they still were really struggling to get it out of their head. And we were chatting on the phone, and I said, how's the company been? Anyone been in touch just to see how you're going? He said, not one call in a year.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, we are going back a little bit, but since privatisation and whatever. But
wow. I'd like to think that wouldn't happen.
I would hope so.
I'd like to think that wouldn't happen nowadays.
Yeah. I think that was the worst case I've heard of. But where was the triggers somewhere to someone, and not even a line manager or even a senior driver had been in touch, and how had the culture drifted into that situation?
That's inhumane.
That's really sad. Can we move on to talk a little bit about the importance of stability for people and change? Two things on my list. So we can do this in whichever order we think is best, but I'd like to talk about how you ended up where you are now, Lucy. So context, you know, of like where we are in the supply chain and, you know, some stuff about that. And then we can't have this conversation about, you know, stability, change and what have you without spending some time talking about GBR, can we?
No.
We've got to talk about that.
Yeah. So I would like to talk a little bit about stress, a little bit about GBR, but do you mean how I ended up more recently working with Mental Wealth Company?
In our little prep call, we'd passed like ships in the night for a while, hadn't we? And kept missing each other's calls and this, that and the other. We'd not talked about actually how you'd moved on from your last role in the techie supply chain, let's call it, to how, and I sort of said, oh, how did you end up working with Wendy? You know, how did that come about? And was sort of really excited to hear the story and was a bit surprised, I think, to hear about kind of how you'd ended up in this wonderful position, but it wasn't quite, you know, planned, was it?
No, not planned at all. And funny, one of the things that I've been learning about with Wendy is a thing called the SCARF model. So SCARF talks about status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness and fairness. So depending on which side you're on, if it's either a threat or something to look forward to. So in terms of autonomy, I had a whole amount of autonomy taken from under my feet at the beginning of the year when I was made redundant. Now, I still say to this day, the MD who I was working with, Gary, brilliant guy, still a friend. It was almost as hard for him to make me redundant as it was for me to hear the news. Right. And that goes, again, back to having a really good culture where you can be honest with one another. But ironically, for 2-3 years beforehand, I used to be the chair for the RIA SME group and on the board of RIA. And the amount of politicians and Network Rail dignitaries and seniors and tier ones, stuff, money's just not flowing through the supply chain. SMEs are struggling. People are losing their jobs. There was one of the rail ministers, I'll not say which one it was.
I mean, they change, you know, like pairs and knickers. We can't keep up.
But at the this is going back a couple of years now, at the RIA chairman's lunch, this particular politician said, oh, and I am aware that supply chain's in bother and people are going to start losing their jobs if we don't sort it out soon. And then David Tonks, any questions like me, I always ask a question. Says, go on then, Lucy, what's your question? It's not a question, it's a statement. Please don't say people are going to. People already are losing their jobs. Like I said, this was a couple of years ago now. Fast forward 18 months after that conversation, and I lose my job. And it's because, now, again, I recognise as a nation, we don't have a lot of money floating around and money has to be spent carefully. But yeah, I got made redundant because there's not enough cash, there's not enough work flowing through the supply chain. We were, it depends on which contract you have. In that scenario, we were everything from a tier 2 to a tier 6, depending on how it's set up. The projects were on stall, so it was literally, or I simplify it to, a case of, is it a couple of people from the factory or is it a senior role that has to go? and the senior all had to go because they still had to process the stuff that was sat in the yard. So it was heartbreaking and absolutely terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And Wendy was one of half a dozen people I texted on very soon after getting the news that I was being put at risk. Do you know of any jobs that are going? I'm going to need a job. And not long afterwards, she rang me up and offered me this role to help her set some strategy to the business, because she's very much in the startup scale-up stage. She's really got to formulate now because she's been doing stuff so instinctively, which is wonderful to see, but kind of put a little bit of structure to it and help it align itself and target itself better, which is how I got to be doing the job. But because I've also been really fortunate to do a whole load in and around leadership training and compassionate leadership, and I've got a whole load of personal interest in this stuff as well, so lots and lots of reading around the area. I was actually down on site in Southampton with Wendy back in July delivering mental wellbeing workshops to the M27 project. And again, it's just staggering to see the impact this stuff has on people and how important it is, and to get feedback in there and then. And also people that you wouldn't expect, because we always hang around. We did three workshops in the same day, and a couple of guys hung around, you know, separately to one another. One of the guys that spoke to us had never spoken to anybody about his personal circumstances. He was here on a visa. He'd been extorted, not by his employers, by a training company. He was at risk of losing his home and all sorts of things. Because of the workshop we'd held, he knew he could speak to somebody about that. And then we flagged it up to the project managers, who took hold of it immediately and helped him immediately. And it's even those tiny little moments. It's honestly, I'm welling up talking about it. Yeah, but it's lovely when you get the feedback from kind of like those guys going, oh, he's a really good manager now because he cares about his people, to seeing somebody take from a really precarious situation into something much more secure.
Can I ask a question? Interestingly, because I have supply chain written down on my book here. You can see it at the bottom, right? Okay. Because I was chatting to someone this morning, mentioned we were doing this recording, and they said some companies are fantastic and have got it now. And I am convinced that some companies are still paying lip service to having the training on board that helps them to support their staff properly through mental health issues. Would I be correct in assuming that not everyone's got it yet, and there might still be some that are ticking the right boxes, or even grudgingly going on courses and actually they're on the phone all the way through and not really listening, or whatever, as I did with my ladder training course at the university, because I hadn't got a ladder, so I didn't pay attention. But the call is out there for some possibly who think, oh, you just need to say we've done it and that'll be fine, to actually realise this is really important.
You need to do it. You absolutely need to do it. And we've got things like the change in procurement, where you've got to demonstrate your social value and you've got to demonstrate your decarb. You've got to demonstrate how many small companies you've got in your own supply chain. But as an imperative, we do have to look after our people better as a society. You know, it's really well documented.
You see my therapy dog in the background.
I have seen your therapy dog.
Sorry to interrupt. This is my therapy dog. This is Bobby.
Hey, Bobby.
Trying to get him on the podcast as usual. Can we go back to something just a little bit more technical? And when we were talking there about how you were made redundant, Lucy, just so people are, you know, aware of how this works, what we're talking about here is how money kind of flows around the industry and how money is spent from kind of, you know, ultimately the industry is funded by the government, you know, at a top level. But that then flows through in a number of ways, through Network Rail's settlement that they get for their control periods and the volumes that they're spending on maintenance and renewals. And what we're sort of getting at here is that they're a bit behind on their spend profile, aren't they? And I think I saw some stats the other day about them being 3% behind where they should be, which maybe doesn't sound a lot to people, but it's 3% of some bloody big numbers, isn't it? So it's an effect in a lot of people, right?
Yeah. So this is actually a conversation I had with somebody at Shadow GBR just yesterday. If you go through your finance training, they always say cash is king. It's cash flow. I mean, you could have millions of pounds worth of stock set on your shelves, but if that's not going out to the client and the client's not paying for it, you then can't pay your staff wages, you can't pay your utility bills, you can't invest in staff training.
It's basic business, right? This is just how business is everywhere, of every size, work.
Yeah. Well, take it to a personal level. You could live in a mansion, but you've got all that money tied up in the bricks and mortar, but you've not got a penny to spend on food. It is as simple as that. You can't have your money tied up idle. It's got to be flowing through. And this is something I have lobbied for with a small L in my SME role with RIA, is just really trying to compel larger organisations to understand the imperative and the importance of money flowing through and of information flowing through. So it's important for a revenue protection person on a train to know how much a ticket costs and what time the train's going to get in. But actually, it's really important for project information and for framework information and for train build schedules to flow through in a really timely manner, because you cannot staff up and you cannot stock up and you cannot train up if you've not got the money to fund it.
Yeah, really, and well put. And you know, it's ironic, isn't it? Because everybody who listens to the podcast knows in my day job, I work for an SME, for a tiny, we're actually called a micro SME, mm-hmm. we're so small. And we are encouraged to bid for work on DFT and on network rail type, you know, big contracts, which state that you'll get extra points if you get an SME on board, because they like to encourage, you know, small, medium enterprises to be involved mm-hmm. in their contracts. But then the behaviours that go alongside that sometimes contradict that, where they try and extend payment terms, or they don't pay on time, or the mm-hmm. money doesn't flow through. And you feel like, do they just forget that actually when you're an SME, it's hand to mouth for some of these businesses, mm. isn't it? Literally,
yeah.
We try and keep the lights on and you're not paying us on time. You think it's only 2 days late, but that 2 days is potentially the difference between paying the utility bill and not, isn't it?
Yeah, ultimately, these small companies, we're paying people's mortgages, we're paying yeah. people's food bills. I obviously will not name any names. Again, a previous project I worked on, a massive, massive tier one, was just not paying, and it had gotten lost somewhere in the bureaucracy, or you know, there was a,
oh, and hey, I get it, things happen, you know, yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah,
but it wasn't until we reported it up to the most senior person in the end client that our contractual customer then sorted it out. It wasn't until their customer yeah. addressed them for not paying us, and that is terrifying. And this was something I loved and feared when I was doing the SME thing for RIA. I was speaking on behalf of my peers in that really wide, vast SME chain. There are so many of us suffer the same problems. And this is all very negative at the moment. I want to switch it to positive in a minute. There are so many of us in that quagmire of, we almost have terms imposed upon us, or if a big customer doesn't pay, we put an awful lot of energy into chasing that invoice. Yeah. But until they get it, or until their customer essentially berates them and makes sure that they behave, it's not right. So I always approach it with, right, come on, what are we doing? What right? What is the SME community doing right for supply chain, right for its customers? What good stuff can we harness to help you deliver projects more efficiently, more creatively, more innovatively? And when you get those conversations going, it's lovely. It's like seeing a light goes on. And on some of the projects I've worked on, where I've been able to work directly with the alliance rather than through a tier two or a tier three, it's brilliant, because again, it's that timeliness of conversation. It's design decisions yeah. that are made there and then, rather than the risk of miscommunication or risk of misinterpretation.
Yeah.
Having that direct, so the alliance model that they have in Southern, for example, if that is embodied and works in practice, it's life-changing, literally.
And that's what they want us to be involved for, isn't it? The SMEs, we're small, we're agile, we're fleet of foot, we're innovative. Yeah. You know, all of those features of the SME yes. is what they want, isn't it? Rather than yeah. everything being held up by big, you know, corporate yeah. Structure. So yeah, we need to remember that positive aspect to it, don't we?
Definitely.
And not focus on the negatives.
Yeah.
Can I just add a sidebar to this, as it were, because it's not just the SMEs necessarily, but individuals who have been hit by this pipeline starting and stopping. So yeah. twice now I have been out to meet new electrification teams who have been recruited from all sorts of other jobs, young people who about 15 years ago, when everything was going to be electrified, and I went to Doncaster and Crewe and met two groups of young people who'd given up other careers, and they'd been told, you've got a job for life because we're going to electrify the railways. And so they had moved careers, moved houses, and one said to me, I can finally get a mortgage, the whole lot. And then within a couple of years, oh, we changed our minds, we're not doing it, you're off. They recruit another group who are doing the middle and main line. And then 2 weeks ago, they went and says, oh, we've decided not to carry on with it for now. And that's fine for the Treasury. But there's that team of people who thought at least they were going to carry on to Sheffield. And while that was being done, things might happen. And it said the team will be stood down. And ministers or civil servants can write that sentence, the team will be stood down. And nowhere are they looking at the people, looking in the eyes of the people who are saying, oh, but by the way, when we say stood down, we mean you finished. or whatever. And there's absolutely no consideration for, it appears, for these are people who have been brought into the industry on the promise of you've got a job for life or you've got a job for years. But this pipeline, whether you're an SME or an individual in certain things, the tap is just going on off. Why would you even risk your mental health on going into a career if that was what it's going to be like?
Yeah, it's exactly that. The stress that I personally felt, and I had help. I am really lucky in that I know a whole host of really good, really helpful, really considerate people. And, you know, I had people sending me job links and helping with my CV and all that sort of stuff. But I'm really well networked. I don't know when I suddenly learned I had to do that, but something clicked in me, and I think it's probably at Rail Alliance. And what I loved when I was at Rail Alliance, it was essentially consultancy for small companies that wanted to diversify into rail. So we were helping companies understand where they fit in that supply chain, who their customers are, because people would automatically think, they make this thing, they're going to sell it to Network Rail. No, actually, let me educate you on
who buys. You're never going to get close to Network Rail. You need to go through here, here, and here.
Yeah, and we do have a very, very convoluted industry.
We do,
But that's why I love the network it's created for me, because it helps you understand that interplay between people as well as between disciplines. But it's absolutely heartbreaking to me when you see like the electrification gangs being stood down, and we are losing people to other sectors. And then when they turn the tap back on, I don't want to be a doomsayer, but when we turn the tap back on, they'll be in highways where the government's investing, not in railways where the expense.
I'm
it annoys me
that.
The language.
Yes.
It kind of just annoys me, the language around it. That, I mean, the rail industry rightly is known for an industry that doesn't lay people off often, you know, and I think in the visible parts of the industry, that's true. You know, train operating companies don't lay people off very often. Network Rail tends to stick to voluntary redundancy. They don't tend to do compulsory redundancy. But there's this bit that sits, that's this huge part of the industry, the whole of the rest of the supply chain that delivers, you know, everything that it delivers for the industry. But we don't use phrases that we use around a factory closure or a steel manufacturer. You know, they're going to make X number of redundancies because the money has run out to keep this factory operating. That kind of language isn't what we use. We say things like they're stood down, which sounds a lot softer, doesn't it? It sounds like we're sort of covering up something there that's the same. It's still people's jobs, and it's still the continuity of work isn't there. So, yeah, maybe we just need to be a bit more honest about that and say, actually, this is job losses. Call it what it is. It's the same as a steel factory, actually.
If I get the chance to speak to a politician, I'd speak to them honestly, constructively, but honestly, these are people's lives. This isn't just you stopping putting some wires up. This isn't just a decarbonisation opportunity for you to say that we're achieving net zero. This is, and you know, sustainability is key for me, but it is so much more than getting people in those positions of power to appreciate the importance of what we're doing as an industry. We are not just about getting people to travel in a metal tube along some metal tracks. We are socioeconomic growth. We are social mobility. We are decarbonisation as well. We represent so many things, but it's not necessarily recognised as much as I would like it to be recognised.
Hear, hear.
Someone I was talking to this morning, who I told we were doing this podcast today, and they said, well, I've had GAD for most of my career, GAD, which is general anxiety
disorder,
and I've known them for years and I never knew. And they said it's all the little things are just constantly in my head, and it's been something I've had to learn and get support with right through my career. And they're about my age, which is hundreds of old. So it's not necessarily a big thing either, is it? For some people, just the way their brain works is that lots of smallish things dealing with can just keep them on a level of finding daily life a bit of a challenge. And he said it comes up and down. It goes up and down as things come and go. So it's not just specifics, is it? For some people, again, that's managers understanding and people that work with them, team members, team leaders, whatever you want to call them, understanding that for some people, it might be a lot of small things in their life, but it's the way their brain handles them and the way they deal with them. And they need some understanding for that, because every brain's different.
You're absolutely right. And anxiety, mental health, stress, put those together, three big things in their own right, lump them together in one. Through statistics that I have seen from four or five of the train operating companies for the last 5 years, bar one instance when it was COVID and another year when it was musculoskeletal, mental health, anxiety and stress are the biggest causes of sick days for train operating companies. And we're not talking about a couple of days, we're talking around about 5 or 6 working weeks, depending on the operator that you're looking at. We are losing, individuals are losing over a month every year from their working life through anxiety, stress, and mental health. And
huge.
Going back to actually not paying lip service to this, but really paying attention and helping organisations, helping their leaders and their managers to look after their wider staff team, to help those people speak up, to recognise for themselves when they're not at their best. Ultimately, that will just mean as a collective, we are performing better. We are looking after one another better. We aren't spending so much money on sick pay and we are keeping people in work. It is as simple as that. We have got people who are reaching burnout, breakdown, and worse, sometimes the worst point is where people are getting to. And ultimately, we're humans. Why can't we just look after one another? Why is it that we need to be able to give a really clear return on investment statistic on this? But I will give you one statistic. 80% of all cases sat in a GP surgery waiting room can be root cause analysis back to stress. Stress is the underlying issue of 80% of the cases in a doctor's waiting room. Stress, unhappiness, not feeling right at work is the biggest reason people leave their jobs. So irrespective of where you are on that hierarchy spectrum, if you're not happy in work, you're going to leave. If stress is a major contributing factor to that, you've then got the physical element of that as well. If you look at the average cost of replacing one position, and this isn't looking at your senior execs, this is blue and white collar, the average cost of replacing one job in the UK, re-recruiting, is around about 30 grand. That is time spent on advertising, interviewing, re-interviewing, training the skills that have been lost. I'd argue that you could easily spend 20 grand, two-thirds of that money, and save five people from leaving work. And then that five, that's 150 grand saved for 20 grand investment. The numbers really are as simple as that, if we can allow ourselves to look at it in that way.
There are politicians, maybe some of them aren't in this country, but maybe in a very, very big nation, who think that all this mental stuff is just a load of rubbish and what they need is a good talking to, and would quite happily, or are, defunding systems for supporting people who have mental health challenges. And if you read the comments underneath some of the stories in the newspapers, there are an awful lot of people in this country who absolutely agree with them, think it's a load of rubbish, think absolutely take the funding away because it's just people moaning and whinging and they should just get on with it. How does it make you feel when you see either people as national leaders saying that or discovering that people in society think they're absolutely right and it's all a load of rubbish?
It's not a load of rubbish. I think I can guess who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And certainly not anybody I would ever want to align with. It's terrifying that people with that approach are world leaders. We do have to look at this from both sides of the coin. So when I first started working with the company, I'm in a massive WhatsApp group of railway people. What's everybody's thoughts on this? And you straight away, I had two or three really good friends going, oh, snowflakes, oh, a load of people, just get on with it. You know, all these young'uns now, they just can't do a proper day's graft. Speak to some of those individuals face to face. And some of them have come from very, very safety critical roles or from military roles or other such. They're also the first people to go and help someone. So I've got a really good mate. He's a lovely, lovely lad, ex-forces. And we've had this conversation. And he's like, yes, some people are snowflaking it, crying wolf. And we do have to be aware that that is a risk. Is this a new vibration white finger or the new, what was it, whiplash?
We spoke about back stuff, didn't we?
Yeah, we do.
When we were doing the prep call and how, you know, there was a period of time in, say, the 90s where, you know, everybody had a bad back, didn't they? Because you could go into your doctor's surgery. It's quite hard to diagnose. It's expensive to send you for a scan. They haven't got the equipment in the GP surgery. We'll diagnose you with a bad back, give you some painkillers and send you on your way. And it's quite an easy, cheap way to get people through the waiting room, isn't it? And you do, I think a lot of people legitimately wonder if there's a bit of that going on now where it's hard to diagnose, the waiting lists are long. Mm. Is it easier for GPs in particular who are under a lot of strain? They've got 10 minutes to see each patient. And actually, is it easier for them to sign them off with something general, like you've got anxiety, you've got stress, whatever it might be, because, well, actually, you can't quite put a pin on it. You can't run a blood test for it. You can't take an x-ray of it. It doesn't work like that. And you send them on their way and they're not your problem anymore. And that's sad, and but true, isn't it? I think.
Yeah. And it's that whole not my problem. That is the problem. So, yes, there are some people who have views that I absolutely do not agree with. And there is some crying wolf in this. It happens with every single case you get. But as a race, humans, we are stressed. I was going to make this point earlier. We still have quite primitive brains, and our brains and our psyche and our physicality has not kept up with the technology that's around us. So we are not wired to receive all these thousands, if not millions, of bits of information that are coming at us left, right, and center. One of the comparisons we give is, you know, olden days, you're a caveman, your biggest fear is, you know, you wake up in the morning, you pick some berries, and oh, there's a saber-toothed tiger, and your stress goes up through the roof. Find a cave, hide, your stress goes back down, and you're calm again, you're back to normal. But with our modern world, with the information that's being blasted at us left, right, and centre, and also our news channels like to feed us bad news as well, so our stress levels are up and down, and we very rarely get to that level of calm. So just endemically, as a creature, we are more stressed. As a species, that's it. Thank you. That's ridiculous that the linguist couldn't think of the word. But, you know,
sometimes you have too many words, Lucy. Yeah. You just don't know which one to choose.
As a species, we are overstressed. In our worlds, in our work worlds, I would therefore argue that we should absolutely do what we can to look after our teams, to care for our teams, to help avoid the stress in a work scenario, and to look after, enable people to look after themselves outside of work, to avoid it getting worse, to avoid it impacting in the workplace. It's preventative maintenance rather than reactive maintenance. That's where we need to get to.
I know we're getting on, but can we just return to GBR momentarily?
Because we've
spoken about this and said, look, it's coming. Mm-hmm. We're told it's coming. We're told it's going to be a huge change, mainly for the positive. Most people would like to say this is going to be mainly a positive thing. But there's some stuff baked in there that's really worrying for people, isn't there? Not least of all the lack of certainty, because we don't have a blueprint or a roadmap. We've got a general direction of travel, which in and of itself, some people will find that stressful, won't they? Because they like certainty. They like the roadmap. But then we've also got some baked in stuff around, some of which we've talked about. There's not enough money in the industry, in the country. So we're making this big change, and inherently that's going to mean efficiencies are going to have to be delivered. We're going to be hearing words like streamlining, or, you know, removing duplication, or joining things back together again to remove complexities, which is lots of ways of saying we're going to get rid of some roles because we've got too many of them. And that, again, is real people, isn't it? So people are potentially looking at this direction of travel and going, what does this mean for me? I don't know. I feel quite stressed about that. Are you picking up on that from people you're talking to, that this is quite stressful?
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I do know, and again, this is from a conversation I had yesterday with Shadow GBR, I do know there's this community of practice where we've got HR practitioners in the operating companies, let's say, working together to help with this change management. But from where I'm sat and the people I'm speaking to staff from across operators, across the country, the day-to-day personnel do not know what's happening, do not know practically what GBR means for them. We're all quite used to being TUPID, but even when you see staff being TUPID from one franchise to another, that's an element of stress in itself. And I know it's a staggered timetable, but what, 18 companies is it, all being TUPID into one? I mean, you know, we've got some brilliant examples. LNER is kind of like the showboat, isn't it? This is what an operator could look like. Maybe, I don't know. There are certain operators who are really highly lauded. What are we doing to learn from them to make sure that as the rest of the operators in their wake are being transferred across as well, how are we helping them now? Because we cannot wait until, is it the 1st of February 2027? Go, right, everything's changed now. Let's get on with it. People are stressed now. People are worried now. People do not know what their job is going to be. They don't even know if they're going to have a job. And they might be catastrophizing. Who knows? But that's who knows. And it goes back to whether we're talking about supply chain or people's livelihoods. If the political leaders, if the top level decision makers could just really speak to the day-to-day staff to understand what we're going through, to understand the impact of stress on people now, because if you do not have a happy, healthy, sane workforce, you are not going to achieve the mission set out by GBR, which is better performance, better customer experience, better innovation. And, you know, another one of that is violence against women and girls. If we've not got that psychological safety to speak up when we see improper things happening, if we've not got the psychological safety to say, right, if we need to make efficiencies, I recommend we do it this way instead of this way, it all ties back to the same thing. So GBR is a huge fear for a lot of people. There are people in talks, there are people in supporting organisations that themselves are disempowered to do anything because they don't have the information, and they don't have the information because the decisions haven't been made yet. So it's a real thorny one. If we don't know what it's going to be, how do we help people now? But we certainly need to be having better, clearer communications with people. We need to be talking about the scenarios that could play out. So we need to help people prepare for it mentally so that they're easing into it rather than just, right, we're now GBR, we're all one team. A previous role I worked for was at L.B. Foster. And this is a real strange anecdote metaphor. When I worked at L.B. Foster, they'd recently bought Portec, this is an American firm. I was in the British arm of it. So an American company had bought an American competitor. So Foster's had bought Portec, who had previously bought out Kelsen, a Canadian competitor. And I swear you not, I would have three engineers arguing which product was better, and they would make three sales trips and not agree on which one was the best one. I'm like, well, actually, I'm here from the one company. Should we go on one visit to one customer and give them all the options? I'm oversimplifying it, but it's how do we align hearts and minds?
Yeah, you can bring together
the same direction.
Yeah, you can bring together a company on paper, but if you don't culturally align them, then you won't actually unlock any of those benefits. And that's the change journey we've got to go on, isn't it? But look, I think to end on a positive on that discussion, we've been doing a lot of getting out and about celebrating Railway 200. The wonderful industry that we love so dearly is celebrating its 200-year birthday of passenger operations, and it's going to be here for another 200 more in some way. It's not going anywhere, is it? So we will weather the storm, and our primitive brains aside, you know, we'll find a way together to support each other through the change, I'm sure. But thanks to you guys at the Mental Wealth Company and others. Big shout out, by the way, to Andy's Man Club, because my husband would be really annoyed with me if I didn't mention them in a discussion about mental health.
I was looking for my Andy's Man Club badge. I've lost my badge. And I was going to hold it up.
Well, let me give another shout out then. So I was on a call this morning with West Midlands Trains. I'm supporting their conference in a couple of weeks' time. And I know there are Paragon, Hall have done this as well. So there are a couple of operators now, let's say, who've built these things called hubs. So in their stations, they are creating spaces accessible to the wider community that brings together a whole host of charities and stakeholders in and around the wellbeing space. So you'll have Andy's Man Club, you'll have Lighthouse, Samaritans, you'll have your CRPE Community Rail Partnerships in there, all coming together to create safe spaces for people to access, for Joe Public to access wellbeing support. And it's amazing. More of that, I'd say.
Yeah, we've got a real asset, haven't we, in railway spaces where we can bring things together. And the railway does bring people and things together. Yes. That's what we're here for. So more of that, please. And we'll weather the storm together. How about that then, Tony? That was a different discussion, wasn't it? Lots of railway, but lots of stuff that isn't all that railway at the same time.
It's important to people in their lives generally, and that I hope there's some things that we've talked about today that people can take with them if railway isn't their employment or isn't their long-term employment, because a lot of it is general stuff as well. As I mentioned, from the higher education sector, it's stuff they need to learn there as well, and they're facing uncertain futures as well, so it does apply in many places. And we've covered some great stuff that we are going to follow up in other things as well. I have a card from the placemat next to me from Women in Rail Awards, because the female freight driver here, she's had a few challenges to deal with, and she's done some social media stuff, but she wants to talk to us. So there are people who want to carry on discussing this, which is important as well.
That has been so wonderful. Lucy, thanks for joining us. I've just really enjoyed talking about the world with you. I could talk for hours. I feel like we should arrange to do a one of these over a glass of wine or something, where we can just set the world to rights.
Yeah, let's do that. I don't know, but thank you both for having me so much. I just care about this stuff. I really care. And there's so many others that really care. So let's care together.
Let's care together. I love that. And what we're going to be caring about next on the podcast, hopefully if this goes in sequence, is something far more technical, because I think we're going to talk about weather, aren't we, Tony? We finally secured our weatherman to, yes, come, to come on the podcast.
Yes, we have a weatherman to talk to in a week or so's time. So, yes.
Excellent.
That's
talk about weathering the storm.
Yeah. We have, hey, good segue. You know, this is good radio fodder. Good segue.
Yeah, right. Weather in a couple of weeks' time. And thank you both. It's been fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you very much.